I'm happy to welcome Stephen Kotler. He is the author of many books. His latest one is called The Rise of Superman, Decoding the Science of Ultimate Human Performance. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back. I love the range of your work. The first time you were on this show, you were talking about chihuahuas.
It's come quite a base.
So now you're talking about, well, first of all, a state of consciousness which is called flow. That term was coined in the 1960s by a Hungarian psychologist with a very long and unpronounceable name. What is you can pronounce it if you want, but what is flow?
So flow is technically defined as an optimal state of consciousness, a state of consciousness where we feel our best and we perform our best. And I think most people have some familiarity with the experience. Flow describes those moments of total absorption. We get so caught up in what we're doing that action and awareness start to merge. Your sense of self, your sense of self-consciousness disappear completely. Time dilates, so that means it slows down, so you get that freeze frame effect like you're in a car crash, or sometimes it speeds up and 5 hours will pass by in 5 minutes. And throughout, all aspects of performance, mental and physical, go through the roof. And we call the experience flow because, as you pointed out, Mihai, Csikszentmihalyi, in the 1960s, was the chairman of the University of Chicago Psychology Department.
That was that unpronounceable,
name. Mihai, Csikszentmihalyi. He conducted what is still one of the largest global psychological studies ever. Went around the world asking everybody he could think of about the times in their life when they felt their best and performed their best. He heard from everybody he talked to that they felt their best and performed their best when they were in flow. So, which was where we, A, learned the state was ubiquitous, and B, where does it get its name? Because it's been called lots of things, runner's high, peak experiences, being in the zone, whatever. It was a technical term for Csikszentmihalyi because when he was asking people about this state, they would say, well, in this state, every decision, every action leads fluidly, seamlessly to the next. So flow actually feels flowy. That's where the term comes from, and that's the loose definition.
So it has brain chemical correlates that have been studied. What's going on actually chemically
in the brain? So Csikszentmihalyi gave us a really great look, and this happened, kind of flow science dates back to the late 1870s, right? So it's gone on for a very long time. 1870s, yeah. And William James, for example, worked on flow states at the turn of the century in Harvard. His student, Walter Bradford Cannon, most famous for finding the fight or flight response, but James thought, noticed that altered states could improve consciousness. His student, Walter Bradford Cannon, gave us one of the reasons why. Flow was another reason different than a fight or flight experience, but it set us on its path. By the end of the 90s, we had mapped the psychology. What are the psychological characteristics of flow? What are its psychological preconditions? Really well. What happened then is there was a revolution in neuroscience, as you know. And over the next 20 years, advances in brain imaging technology, EEG, fMRI, all those kinds of things, allowed us for the very first time in history to kind of peel back the hood and see what was going on. And what we found was actually shocking. So for most of the 20th century, the general thinking on optimal performance, there was this what was called the 10% brain myth, the idea that we use only 10% of our brain at any one time, dating back to Dale Carnegie in the 30s. Carnegie came along and said, optimal performance flow states, this must be your whole brain on overdrive. And that kind of that thinking dominated the 20th century. Turns out the exact opposite is going on. In flow, parts of the brain aren't becoming more active. They're actually deactivating. This is known as transient hypofrontality. Transient means temporary. Hypo, H-Y-P-O, it's the opposite of hyper, means to slow down, to shut off, to deactivate. Frontality is the prefrontal cortex, the part of your brain that's right behind your forehead where most of your higher cognitive functions are housed. So why is time so strange in a flow state? Because time's calculated all over the prefrontal cortex, and when parts of it start to wink out, we can't separate past from present from future, and we're plunged into what scientists call the deep now. There is also, as you mentioned a second ago, a very profound neurochemical cascade in flow. Most people kind of heard about endorphins in the brain as the cause of runner's high, and there was some controversy about this. That's all settled. We now know that endorphins in the brain do cause flow, but so do four other chemicals, norepinephrine, dopamine, anandamide, and serotonin. In combination, these are all five are extremely potent performance-enhancing chemicals, but they're also very potent pleasure chemicals, so potent, in fact, that flow is considered the most addictive state on Earth. Of course, scientists don't like the word addictive, so they use autotelic, which means an end in itself. Sometimes they say flow is the source code of intrinsic motivation, whatever the terminology, what they mean is once an activity starts producing flow, we'll go very, very, very far out of our way to get more of it. One of the reasons this is super critical, America today, if you look at kind of the round number, 71% of workers say they're actively disengaged on the jobs. They don't like what they do. It bores them. They're not present. The other 29% have jobs that produce flow, and they love it and can't wait to get more of it. So if we're just kind of looking at that kind of fundamental metric, just motivation, flow is fundamental.
How does that worker statistic correlate with the actual income that they're earning from their jobs?
Well, it's interesting because as you probably know this, Daniel Kahneman did this research. Income and happiness or well-being, life satisfaction, correlate only to a certain point. They usually, in America, it's roughly around $70,000 a year. It's basically basic expenses and then some. And then happiness and money totally diverge. And what takes over is flow. What we know from Csikszentmihalyi's work is not only is flow ubiquitous, but the happiest people on earth, the people who score off the charts for life satisfaction, are those with the most flow in their lives.
What is the adaptive significance on an evolutionary level of these brain chemicals, of this brain state?
So there's two reigning theories, and both actually trace back to our relationship with animals. We started this conversation talking about small furry predators in my book about humans and animals. I also talk a lot about flow in there. Why? Evolutionarily, we ran down our prey. So flow came. There's one of two reasons flow emerged from that. First of all, the obvious. Endorphins kill pain. Anandamide kill pain. And they're very potent. Just to give you an example, the most common endorphin in the brain is 100 times more potent than medical morphine. So obviously, if you're running down your prey, anybody who gets a little more of these neurochemicals is going to be able to run farther, get more prey, have more food, procreate more, have more kids, on and on. The other option is there's a joint version of flow called group flow. It happens when a whole group of people get together. If you've ever seen a fourth quarter funt comeback in football or taken part in, you know, a brainstorming session, then you've probably tasted group flow. So one of the things we all...
Or trance dance,
right. Gone to a rave. Well, group flow also crosses species lines. So humans can get into group flow with dogs. One of the things that happens in group flow, in any state of flow, is pattern recognition, information processing goes through the roof. And people in states of group flow often talk about it as feeling like psychic communication. It's really massively jacked up pattern recognition, but it feels like psychic communication. Why is this important? When we used to run and hunt large animals with packs of dogs, we didn't speak the same language as the dogs, and we had to coordinate our behavior very specifically or you could get hurt. And you've got to remember that on the veldt, in days of old, an injury was most often fatal. If you get a flesh wound, it turns into gangrene, it rots, the whole arm needs to come off, etc., etc. So having near psychic communication brought on by jacked up pattern recognition might have been the driver more than the pain relief showed up by flow. But either way, we know it goes back a ways in evolutionary history. We know it serves a fundamental purpose.
Now, do animals like dogs or bears or fish or whatever have these same brain states?
Well, we know they're prevalent in dogs, both because kind of the same neurobiology is the same, and because researchers at the University of Arizona specifically looked at this question. They actually looked at humans, dogs, and ferrets. And ferrets, they taught them all how to run on treadmills, and then they analyzed their brain chemistry as they went, and they found some of the neurochemicals that show up in flow were present in the dogs, not present in the ferrets. So while the neurobiology should technically work in all mammals, and it had previously believed that flow might cross all species lines, the small furry prayer, I wrote that we thought it showed up in all mammals. Now we are starting to figure out that maybe it's not all mammals, maybe it's just social mammals, and we're not exactly certain.
Yeah, I suppose it's hard to study the brain states of grizzly bears or things like that. I mean,
tricky to get into a scanner.
Yeah, exactly. So we're talking to Stephen Kotler about his book, The Rise of Superman. What is your own experience of these flow states?
So I got interested in this research. When I was 30 years old, I got Lyme disease, and I spent the better portion of 3 years in bed. And for those who don't know what Lyme is, it's sort of like the worst flu you've ever had crossed with paranoid schizophrenia. And by the end of it, the doctors had pulled me off drugs because there was nothing more they could do for me. My stomach lining was bleeding out. I was a mess, and I was functional about 10% of the time. Literally most everything I did was lie on a couch and moan. And I was suicidal because all I was going to do from that point on was be a burden to my friends and my family. There was really nothing anybody could do for me, and I wasn't getting any better. In the middle of all this, a friend of mine showed up at my doorstep and demanded that we go surfing. And it was a laughable request, right? I couldn't move. I couldn't walk across a room, and she wanted to go surfing, and she was a pain in my butt and wouldn't leave and kept badgering me and wouldn't leave. And finally, after like 3 hours, I was like, what the hell? What is the worst that can happen? At least she'll shut up. Let's go surfing. Fine.
Or you could die in a wave.
Right, seriously. Make my life a little easier at that point. And they, you know, they kind of carried me to the car, pretty much put me in the car. They drove me to the beach. They had to walk me out to the waves, and we went to Sunset Beach in Los Angeles, which is the wimpiest beginner wave in the world. And the tide was low, and the waves were tiny, like 3-foot waves. No one was out. The water was warm, and they gave me a board the size of a Cadillac. And I was out there like 30 seconds, and a wave came, and muscle memory just took over. And I spun the board around, and I paddled twice, and I popped to my feet, and I popped.
So you knew how to surf?
I barely knew how to surf, but I did know how to surf. It had been 5 years at that point since I'd surfed, and I was never great, but I knew how to surf. Popped my feet and popped up into this other dimension. I mean, my senses were incredibly heightened. Time had slowed down, panoramic vision, and I had no pain, and I felt great. I mean, I was clear-headed. I had all these things I hadn't felt in 3 years, and that alone, I mean, it was so exciting. It was so amazing to feel great. Caught 4 more waves that day, and after the 5th wave, I was so disassembled. They brought me home. They put me in bed. People had to bring me food for like 2 weeks because I couldn't get out of bed. And on the 15th day, which is the day I could walk again, I went back to the ocean, and I did it again. And over the course of about 6 months, when the only thing that was different in my life was I was having these crazy flow state experiences in the waves and I was occasionally going surfing, I went from 10% functionality to like 80% functionality. And my first question was, well, surfing is not a known cure for chronic autoimmune conditions, so what the hell is going on? More alarmingly, Lyme can go in cycles. So sometimes it can kind of disappear from your body for a couple weeks. It's a birth rate, die-off thing, doesn't matter. But I had... The only time Lyme is fatal is when it gets into your brain. I was a science writer. I was a rational materialist. I didn't have quasi-mystical experiences. So I thought, even though I was feeling better, that the disease was working its way into my brain and I was dying. So what it started out as a, what the hell is going on with me? And what I quickly realized, some of this is Herb Benson's work at Harvard, but all of the neurochemicals that show up in flow massively, massively amplify the the immune system. And more importantly, they also calm the nervous system down. So they reset the nervous system to zero. An autoimmune condition is a haywire nervous system. So to have these neurochemicals resetting my nervous system towards zero, flushing out the stress hormones, et cetera, and then pumping me full of these immune-boosting other neurochemicals was a huge addition to my health. But what I very quickly realized in this research is the exact same techniques that were getting me from subpar back to normal could take normal people and turn them into supermen. And that was sort of the origin of all of this.
When you say supermen, I get this sort of Nietzschean feel.
And you should. You absolutely should. I don't mean a guy with a cape and tights. And I apologize for the fact that it's not superhuman was a lousy word. It didn't work. And I couldn't figure out what the co-ed version is. And I tossed and I turned and I finally gave up. But I do.
Well, and the Nietzschean superman has a very sexist historical connotation.
He does,
to
but it
wasn't.
I mean, I'm going all the way back. You know, there's 4th century philosophers who called it hyperanthropos. There are terms that predate Nietzsche. George Bernard Shaw took Nietzsche's Übermensch and turned it into Superman, and that's kind of what I leaned on. And what I really mean by that is the tradition of people pushing themselves to their outer limits and exceeding human possibility. That's the tradition that this sits within.
And so you studied in the book and tell many, many stories of people who do what we call extreme sports, action-adventure sports, doing backflips off of skyscrapers, jumping off of cliffs, all these things that, I mean, full disclosure, I have zero interest in any of that stuff myself. I'm not impressed by it. I think if you want to do it, that's great, but I don't really see why it would be a role model to anybody, but this is something that you've really taken and run with and gotten really interested in.
There are reasons why there are action adventure sport athletes at the heart of Rise of Super. And first, before we talk about that, let's just talk about flow in society for half a second. Flow in business. McKinsey, the huge business research firm, did a 10-year study. They found top executives in flow report being 5 times more productive than out of flow. Five times is 500%. It means you go to work on Monday in flow, take Tuesday through Friday off, and get as much done as your steady state peers. That's a massive amplification. Now the caveat. They also found that average person spends less than 5% of their work life in flow. So that's not nearly enough time. What is unusual at action adventure sport athletes is twofold. First, if you look at these sports as a data set, forget everything you just said about why you don't like them and just look at the data. What you see over the past 25 years is nearly exponential growth in ultimate human performance. So that's performance when life or limb is on the line. It should be the slowest growth category from an evolutionary perspective. Yet, we have nearly exponential growth. That's staggering. Nothing like that has ever happened before in the history of humankind. Sports performance is slow, it's steady, it's governed by the laws of evolution. At no point in history does it quintuple in a decade. That's exactly what we're seeing across the boards in action adventure sports, surfing, skating, skiing, mountain biking, et cetera, et cetera.
As we saw in the Olympics with this, what's it called, half pipe, where people are doing crazy flips on their snowboards and things like that?
For sure, the easy example for everybody to grasp is surfing. So here is a 1,000-year-old sport. From 400 AD to 1996, the biggest wave anybody's ever surfed is 25 feet. Above that is considered absolutely impossible. Scientists, surfers, everybody agrees it's beyond possible. Susan Casey, in her bestseller book, The Wave, said trying to catch a wave bigger than 25 feet by windmilling away on your stomach is like trying to catch the subway by crawling. Today, less than a decade later, surfers are pushing into 100-foot waves. So that's one example. Another example is snowboarding. 1992, the biggest thing anybody had ever jumped over on a snowboard is the Baker Road Gap. It's in Washington. It's 40 feet end-to-end. 40 feet is a big jump. Today, right now, snowboarders are clearing 230 feet. That's incredible. Nothing like that has ever happened in sports before. So the first reason these athletes are at the center of Rise of Superman is just so this is the greatest show in the history of the world. We are living through the greatest show in the history of the world, and I don't care if you don't like these sports at all, to see what is now possible for humans kinesthetically, it's amazing. But more important is why. Why is this happening? And the answer is that these athletes have figured out how to reproduce the state of flow reliably better than anybody else, arguably, in the history of the world. So what's the big deal about the athletes isn't, you know, for me personally, as an action sport athlete, I'm amazed by it.
But do you consider yourself an action sport athlete?
Sure. I mean,
because of the surfing?
No, surfing, skiing, rock climbing, windsurfing, mountain biking.
Right.
Take your pick.
Okay.
You know, it's a huge weekly part of my life, if not daily, depending on what season it is. But the point here is that we can use these guys as case studies. We can figure out what they're doing to get into flow reliably, and we can apply that information across all domains of society. So that's the big deal about the action sport athletes.
I recently did a radio program with a woman who'd made a film. It's called Walking the Camino, and it's about that pilgrimage route across the top of northern Spain where people walk 500 miles. And she said the people who get injured the most tend to be people who are pushing themselves. And the people who are pushing themselves tend to be Americans because Americans are so involved in competition and don't know how to find their own pace. And I was thinking of that, and there's a wisdom lesson in there about finding your pace and not pushing yourself. And then I read your book yesterday and over the last couple of days, and it's all about pushing yourself.
Yes and no. So what have these athletes done to hack flow? Well, what we now know, because of all the neurobiology that's been done, there are 17 flow triggers. These are preconditions that bring on more flow. There are 3 environmental, 3 psychological, 10 social, and 1 creative. All of these triggers can be applied pretty much anywhere. But what you're talking about is one of the psychological triggers. And this was Mihai Csikszentmihalyi's work. We knew this back in the 60s. It's known as the challenge skills balance, or ratio is a more appropriate term. So what we know about flow, all the flow triggers are the same. Flow follows focus. Every one of these triggers is a way of driving focus into the now. So we pay most attention to what we're doing when the task at hand is slightly harder than the skills we bring to bear, right? You want to stretch, you don't want to snap. Csikszentmihalyi and a Google mathematician sat down. They did a back-of-the-envelope calculation, and my organization, the Flow Genome Project, has looked at this number, and 4% is the difference they get. It's a general rule between skills and challenge. So the challenge should be about 4% greater than your skills to maximize attention and give you the greatest shot at pushing into flow. So what does this mean for Americans, as you said? Well, for super high achievers, the problem with 4% is most people blow by it without even noticing. They'll go for something that's 50% harder, 20% harder, or, you know, in the case of your 500-mile march, you know, these people show up and think they're in a race and forget that it's 500 miles that they're going to walk, and they blow by 4%, and, you know, A, they don't get flow, which would maximize the trip for them and make them actually probably get there faster, but B, they end up injuring themselves. It's a problem for underachievers because 4% is actually the point at which you start to get pretty uncomfortable. It's where you are pushing yourself. You're outside. As a writer, this is a level of kind of vulnerability in my material that it makes me uncomfortable. It's not too much, but it makes me uncomfortable. That's always kind of where I know I'm edging toward closer to my sweet spot. It's when I'm a little uncomfortable with the amount of truth I'm telling in my writing. It's a good marker. And, of course, this 4%, it differs for everybody, everything else. But even if you look at these, you know, surfers in these 100-foot waves, what most people don't realize, because they look at a 100-foot wave and they think, oh, I could never do that. But what they didn't realize is there's years and years and years of 2-foot waves, 3-foot waves, 5-foot waves, 10-foot waves, 15-foot. It's 4% plus 4% plus 4%. It's slow and steady wins the race.
We're talking to Stephen Kotler about his book, The Rise of Superman. What are some of these other flow triggers?
Well, let's talk about a couple of the ones that the action adventure sport athletes pull most reliably, and maybe how they can be applied elsewhere. As I said, flow follows focus. So the first trigger action adventure sports rely on, which is the most obvious, is known as high consequences. Flow follows focus, and consequences always catch our attention, right? Physical consequences grab hold of our attention. They drive it into the now. They say, this is important, pay attention. But what's cool about this is we now know what's going on underneath that, and it just doesn't have to be physical consequences. You need risk to drive flow, but you can hack the physical risk if you're not interested in being an action adventure sport athlete with emotional risk.
What do you mean hack risk? What does that mean?
You can substitute. You can trade out. You don't need physical risk. You can replace it with intellectual risk, creative risk, social risk. If you're a shy woman, literally raising your hand at the meeting is enough to pull this trigger. And it's also very individual. So for big wave surfers, they may need to paddle into a 50-foot wave to pull this trigger. But for, you know, as I said, the shy woman, merely raising your hand in a meeting and speaking up could be enough to pull that trigger. So that's one of the triggers.
It's tricky business, too, because sometimes you take a risk and you fall on your face, and you are very unlikely to ever try that thing again, whatever it was. I know this personally.
I think it depends on your relationship to risk and, you know, how big of a risk you're taking. I think risk is one of those things that you should do all the time. You should take as many risks as you possibly can, but small, slow steps forward. When you take one of those giant risks, of course you fall on your face. One of the things that's really interesting, and you're seeing this a lot in Silicon Valley, a lot of the Silicon Valley practices, the kind of the people management stuff that they're doing drives employees into flow. A lot of it is built that way. And the fail forward attitude, the idea that you have to fail forward, they're giving employees space to take risks and space to fail, is huge for this. Because a lot of people don't build in the space to fail. We learn from failure. This is how we get better. You absolutely have to be okay with it, and you have to pick yourself up and keep going. But we need to build that space for failure into our lives if we're going to really harness these states.
I was reading your book, and I was talking to somebody I know who is a classical musician, a concert musician, and said, you know, I'm reading this book about flow states. What do you know about flow states? He goes, oh, yeah. That's what happens when you're in rehearsal. That's what happens when you're preparing. That's what happens when you're practicing. I said, well, what about your concert? Isn't that where the big flow state happens? He said, nope. He said, that's where the result of your practice is manifested, but that's not where the flow state is. And then I said, well, is that just you? He said, well, I've talked to a lot of people about this, and he said, that's pretty much the same as everybody I've talked to. Now, he hasn't talked to all musicians, and maybe those people who are like, you know, playing in jam band music festivals or something are having another chemically enhanced experience or whatever, but...
So, you bring up some really interesting points. There's a lot of cool stuff to unpack in there. one of the things you pointed out, and first of all, we know musicians and flow happen all the time. When musicians get into their groove, the beatnik jazz musicians used to call it being in the pocket. They had a term for it specifically. So it definitely does happen with musicians. But what's interesting, so this was a work of a woman named Susan Jackson, brilliant psychologist. In the 90s, she figured out that you can separate, used to be peak performance, flow states, and peak experience were all thought to be the same thing. Now we know that while flow, peak performance, peak experience, and flow can overlap and do in certain cases, they don't always. So what your friend is talking about is peak performance without flow. Why flow shows up in rehearsal and not in the performance is because there's a challenge skills ratio, and the live audience clearly ups the stress level for your friend. He pushes him out of the challenge skills ratio, pushes that over a little bit, and flow is sort of on the other side of the fight or flight response. You have to move through that response into flow. If cortisol levels and norepinephrine levels are too high, which seems to be the case, while that can keep you driven into the now and can sometimes produce peak performance, doesn't always produce flow. It can sometimes block you from the flow state. So that seems to be what's happening.
There's another thing, and that is that if you compare a classical pianist to a beatnik musician, I mean, there's a lot of people who are in the flow state and they're having a wonderful time, but watching them is super boring because they're having their own experience, but what they're doing does not translate out to the rest of the world.
Well, when I was talking about beatnik musicians, I'm talking about John Coltrane, Miles Davis, people like that. Now, those are people whose music definitely translates out into the world. For sure, you know, there can be times when the art doesn't translate to other people and times that it does. Flow is an internal experience. It's not really a record of how the music is being received.
We're talking to Stephen Kotler about his book, The Rise of Superman, Decoding the Science of Ultimate Human Performance. So if a person is in a flow state and they become aware of it, does that stop the state?
So that's it's an interesting question. The quick shorthand is probably yes. What happens in flow is, so the brain has a fixed energy budget, right? But it's an energy hog. It's 2% of our mass, but it uses up 20% of our energy. So the first order of business for the brain is, how do I conserve energy? So what happens in the brain is, as your information processing attention goes up, as your more energy goes in those directions, the brain performs an efficiency exchange. It trades conscious, slow, energy-expensive processing for subconscious processing. The explicit system is replaced by the implicit system. The implicit system is a lot faster and is a lot more energy efficient. So it takes over and you kind of get to watch it work. When you become too conscious of it work, it kicks you out of this state. It breaks it. And you can, people who are really good at this, if we talk about the extreme athletes, one of the things they're really good at is getting kind of kicked out of flow, but having the brain, the fluid brain control, to move themselves back in immediately so it sort of exists as their baseline. Other people get kicked out of flow and they can't get back at all. Flow is really fundamental to the coding industry and software, and there's a belief in this. There's a bunch of data, and I don't know if this is across the boards or just in coding, but there's data from software that says once you get kicked out of flow, and it can take you a second to get kicked out, it takes a minimum of 15 minutes to get back, if you can get back at all. And that's just data from the coding industry. It may change, or it may be ubiquitous across the boards. We don't yet know.
Well, I wonder, I mean, if you have a ballet dancer, and I've seen this, where a ballet dancer is dancing so beautifully you can't even believe it, and then they fall, and then they get back up again. Or some of these Olympics figure skaters whom we recently saw who did the same thing, who fell and then went back into an incredible performance. They didn't have 15 minutes, they had seconds.
Right. And I've seen it happen bunches of different ways. I think, honest to God, it's really just practice. One of the things that the athletes are so good at, since flow is such a rare occurrence in most people's lives, we don't get to practice in the state with the state. One of the things that, because these athletes are getting into flow so often, and some of them can extend the state for really long periods of time, they're getting to practice in the state more, and they're bring themselves back. I find in my own life, it's been a long time that I've kind of put flow at the center of my life, and it's fundamental. My work in animals, it's fundamental my work as a writer, it's fundamental as my work as an athlete, all those things kind of come together. I have found I can get back into flow fairly quickly. It doesn't usually take me 15 minutes if I get kicked out. So I think that's a practice makes perfect thing, but I can't be certain.
Now, there are people, whether they be musicians or artists or writers or actors or extreme athletes, as you write about in your book, all of them have devoted their lives to doing something really well, out of love, out of habit, out of ambition, whatever the sort of combination of motivations is that makes a person do something that nobody else would do, would, you know, practice for many, many hours a day, make a lot of personal sacrifices. So a flow, as you describe it, comes as a result of that. We also, and dopamine and endorphins and all these chemicals are released and so on. We also have this kind of weird state where we've got, first of all, drugs. We've also got video games, which stimulate those kinds of states. And you've got generations of young people who are addicted to their phones and to their little video games. And they're also getting those brain chemicals. But when they're done, they're not really happy. I mean, you there have been tests done where kids come out of hours of watching video games and they're not tranquil or happy. And so what's the comparison there?
So it's a little complicated, and there's still huge questions to answer. But first of all, flow, as you pointed out, it's fundamental for video games, meaning like how much flow a video game produces is the number one metric used to predict a video game's success on the market. That said, oftentimes, if you kind of look at the papers and look at the research, what they're calling a flow state is actually a low-grade dopamine reward loop. Right, you can have a dopamine reward loop that has nothing to do with flow. Gambling, for example, sometimes that'll produce it too. It reinforces addictive behavior. Now, there are video games that seem better at kicking you over into flow, and because the neurochemicals that show up in flow, there's a cascade, norepinephrine and adrenaline on the front end. It goes into nitric oxide, into dopamine, et cetera, et cetera. So we don't right now seem to have video games that many. I don't want to say all, and nobody's really looked deeply, that kick people into the full kind of neurochemical experience. It seems like we're getting a low-grade reward loop. It's very addictive, but it may not be the full flow state. What's interesting, and where this gets really cool and exciting and interesting and applicable to everybody, is so one of the things neurochemicals do in the brain is they tag experiences. They're like big neon signs that say, this is important, save me for later. Right? The more neurochemicals that show up during experience, the better chance it moves into long-term holding. That's essentially what learning is. Flow is a massive dump of neurochemicals, which is why, for example, when the military has done studies where they introduce flow artificially using transcranial magnetic stimulation and neural feedback or a couple of other ways, they found that snipers, for example, in flow learn 230% faster than normal. There's a non-military study, a bunch of them, where they were using all kinds of snipers and archers and all kinds of marksmen, and they found that flow, you can artificially induce flow and take somebody from a novice to an expert level in 50% less time. So it seems to suggest, by the way, that those famous 10,000 hours to mastery, flow may cut them in half. It literally shortens the path to mastery. So why is this all cool? Because right now learning-based video games suck. They're boring, they're horrible, nobody wants to play them, but there are a lot of learning researchers who are trying to make learning video games that are, A, much more kind of autotelic and flowy and really fun to play.
Autotelic?
Autotelic means an end in itself. When something is autotelic, we do it for the sake of doing it. So what's cool about this is if we can actually find ways to produce all five of these neurochemicals during a video game experience and actually produce true flow, we can create learning-based video games that are totally addictive and literally can teach you twice as fast as normal. That's really exciting.
So some of these athletes, actually many of these top-of-their-game extreme athletes, some of whom you profile in the book, die. They die doing what they love most. So again, this question of what's going on here? Are these the people you want to hold up as your role models, as your heroes? I mean, to me, give them all Darwin Awards.
Well, okay, it's a fair point, and for certain, I always tell people that, you know, flow is not self-help. This is not like take two pills and climb Everest in the morning. Nothing like that. These are fundamental neurochemicals. You're playing with, you know, very, very core neurochemicals with very fundamental motivations in the brain. These are powerful states, and they're addictive, and there is a dark side to flow, and this has been documented. There's research around this. And it happens for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons that it happens is most people don't know what they're doing with flow states. They're not familiar enough with them. They don't know about the triggers. They don't know there's a flow cycle. There's a bunch of there's so that some of it, some of what's going on, you're right. The body count has gone up and up and up in action sports. Some of this is that flow continues to draw, push up the risk quotient, and it does. Flow will cause you to take greater and greater risks. And that's going to happen, and it can be dangerous.
And also, you are then working in a culture of other people who are doing these things, and presumably you egg each other on.
For sure that's going on, but you got to stop and you got to think about what we're talking about. We are talking about pushing the frontier of kinesthetic possibility. These people are reinventing what's actually physically possible for our species. And the idea that such, you know, grand adventure should be safe, it's silly. Honestly, when has pushing the frontier of anything been safe? It's never been safe. And the fact that, you know, the fact that our protection systems are getting better, you know, to me it's surprising that more people aren't dying, and I think it's a testament to the athletes and how good they've become at managing these states and working within it that they are getting safer and the equipment is getting safer. But for sure, this is dangerous stuff. But when has pushing on anything in human development been totally safe? I don't think you would expect that anyplace else, so it seems ridiculous to expect these people who are literally reinventing what's possible for human beings to do with their bodies, why is that going to be safe, and why should we have that expectation?
Now, when you talk about all these chemicals, and we've talked a little bit about dopamine addiction, is the flow state itself addictive?
Oh, yeah. People consider it the most addictive state on Earth. But, and this is, you know, I'm sort of paraphrasing Csikszentmihalyi here, what's really interesting about flow is because it's based on challenge and skills, right? You need skill acquisition to get into flow. You need to constantly up the challenge level. It is an addiction that leads forward into the future, whereas all the other addictions, drugs, gambling, sex, etc., lead backward.
So how does it lead forward? I mean, okay, so you can do a quadruple, triple twist somersault off the edge of a cliff or whatever.
Well, it leads forward for me as a writer because I get into flow states all the time when I write, and not only it compels me to want to write more, I want to come back the next day. As an artist, it brings me back to the work despite how much difficulty that's kind of built in among, you know, the creative arts. You know how hard that is, and yet I want to come back and do it over and over and over again and devote my life to it. That's the upside here.
So would you say that if you develop a flow state in surfing, that kind of transfers over to writing?
This is a great question, and I'll tell you the quick story is Small Furry Prayer, another book I wrote. So I
love that book, ladies and gentlemen. If you haven't read it, go out immediately. And besides this book, buy Small Furry Prayer. Anyway, go ahead.
All right. So here's the secret story that nobody knows about Small Furry Prayer. I turned in the book. My editor gave back to me, this was in May, and they said, well, the first half is great, the first 110 pages we love, but the second 200 pages suck and you need to throw it out and start over. And I said, okay, that's fair. I knew something was wonky with it, I knew they were right, and I did.
Really?
Yeah. And I got stuck. I had never had writer's block before in my life. It was June and I couldn't write. It was July and I couldn't write. Book was due in October. It was August. And I couldn't write at all. End of August, they're running the lifts at Pajarito. I've never gone downhill mountain biking in my life. Friend of mine from Los Alamos calls me up, tells me this. I get my cross-country bike. I buy some used pads at the thrift store, hockey pads, I believe, and put on my ski helmet. And I go downhill mountain biking for the first time. Throws me into a deep flow state. I come home after it. I sit down. I don't want to waste the flow state. I'm still in it when I get back home. And I start writing. I write for 2.5 weeks straight. I sleep in between, but I write literally for 2.5 weeks straight. I finish the book, turn it in. Now, I don't even have time to edit the last 200 pages. It's unedited. I turn it in. My editor comes back to me. They've got all kinds of changes they want on the first 110 pages. The last 200 pages were written in a nonstop flow state, translating from action sports into writing, and there's not a change in the book. It's exactly how it came out. And by the way, I have no idea who wrote that book. It literally just kind of came forth in a flow state. But the really short version of what I'm saying here is the more flow you have, the more flow you have. These are pathways in the brain. Flow is a skill like anything else. You're just training the brain how to produce this state. Like you train the brain to learn how to meditate, you train the brain to learn how to get into flow. It doesn't matter where you're training the brain. You can crossover from an artist into an athlete. My flow states as a writer help my flow states as a skier, and vice versa.
We're talking to Stephen Kotler about his book, The Rise of Superman, Decoding the Science of Ultimate Human Performance. Now, okay, there's flow states, and all of us have probably been in them at one state or another, and some people more than others and whatnot. You can't live there all the time. What is the balance? Talk about the balance and the other states of mind, because I'll tell you, I love and get a tremendous amount out of just being home with the dogs, or just taking a mellow walk and not pushing and just kind of just being, or reading, or talking. I mean, there's a lot of things that aren't flow states. So what's the balance?
Well, I think there's a huge balance, of course. You know, you don't have to. People want to live in flow states. They have this idea. First of all, they have an idea that they can, and it's not actually possible.
Which is the mark of a person who is dealing with addiction.
Yeah, on a certain level, they probably are. What we used to believe is that flow was a binary. It's like a light switch. You're either in the zone or you're out of the zone. We now know that flow is a four-stage cycle, and it was Herb Benson at Harvard who kind of mapped the neurobiology of this. But two of the stages of flow don't even feel flowy. The front end of the state, it's known as struggle. This is a loading phase. If you're an athlete, this is skill acquisition. You're learning to do something new. As a writer, this is the point at which I'm doing all my research. I'm talking to hundreds of people. I'm reading books. I'm reading articles. Struggle is really unflowy. You're making yourself as frustrated as possible. Really, you're pushing yourself up to that limit.
And as you describe in the book, there are people who are called adrenaline junkies, but that's not really the part that they enjoy.
Yeah, it's interesting. The thing that when you talk to top athletes, most of them, and I'm not a top athlete, but I'll just tell you for myself, this is also true, they don't really like adrenaline. If you're feeling adrenaline, as a general rule, these athletes will tell you it's too much fear. It's a sign to back away. It's a sign, don't do this. It's stupid. Something bad is going to happen. And you need to learn that. They always say that people can get by kind of on adrenaline, you know, up until the point that they get hurt. And that's when they start to learn the mental game and flow. And it's a very different sensation. And you can get addicted to that adrenaline rush, because it can be very addictive. But you're going to end up dead or in the hospital over the long haul if you're an action sport athlete trying to run that way. It's a totally different state. But the chemicals, by the way, in this struggle phase are very similar to the adrenaline response. Norepinephrine is heightening. Cortisol is heightening. Adrenaline is heightening. Same exact response. To move into flow, there's a relaxation response. So a lot of people talk about they'll be working. Then they went and took a shower or went to walk their dogs, as you said, do something just to take your mind off the problem. That is often enough to kick people into flow. There's a global release when you relax. It's called the relaxation response. There's a global release of nitric oxide. It's a signaling molecule, and it flushes all these stress hormones out of your body, and the positives, dopamine, endorphins, serotonin, those start to rise in their place. So that's the third stage of the cycle. And on the back end, there's a memory learning consolidation recovery phase. And this is another part. You talked about the dark side earlier. This is the real danger for people. They come out of the flow state where you feel like Superman. You can do amazing things. And on the other side of it, those neurochemicals are all expensive to produce. That body takes a little while to replenish them, to build back up. This is a recovery period where you're supposed to be relaxing and chilling out and not striving and forward. But if what happens is people go from feeling like Superman to feeling very, very mortal, they get really anxious. They're not in flow. It's their addictive behavior. They want to be back in flow immediately, and they get gripped. Two things happen here. First of all, in this phase, this is where all that advanced learning is happening. You're blocking it. As cortisol goes up, learning goes down. So you're blocking that great learning, but you're also keeping yourself from moving back into the struggle stage and starting the cycle all over again. People can get hung up there for years, and it gets really dark. People who don't know this is going on can get extremely depressed here.
I think it's interesting to bring this into questions surrounding education, because when people talk about education and testing and technology in the schools and all this stuff, my own sense of things is that the only time I ever accomplished anything in school in ages K through 12 was when I got lost in something. Got lost in reading a book or an art project or listening to the teacher talk about geometry and getting what a proof was or whatever that thing is. And it is that phenomenon of losing yourself that is really antithetical to the phenomenon that you have when you're being tested most of the time, especially kids who don't like being tested. And it would just be interesting to kind of bring this conversation into the experiences of young people.
Yeah, so here the research is really solid, actually, on flow and learning in education spaces. And one of the reasons is, a bunch of years ago, Csikszentmihalyi and a University of Utah education expert named Kevin Rothunde went looking for really high flow environments. And one of the places they found them the most was Montessori education. And there are a bunch of reasons for this. It has basically Montessori education is a high flow trigger environment. A lot of the built around 90 periods of uninterrupted concentration. It's built around follow your own curiosity. So people talk about needing to harness their passion to get into flow, and they think this is some metaphysical new agey thing. No, flow follows focus, and if we're passionate about something, we pay more attention to it. So self-directed learning, very important. Autonomy is really important for driving flow. We get into flow much more easily when we are in control of what we're doing, right, on a certain level. Uninterrupted conversation is also very deeply embodied, learning through doing. So all your senses are kind of jacked up in Montessori education because there's a lot of learning through doing. It's very tactile. Drives attention. But one of the reasons they think Montessori kids across the board out-test regular kids, whether it's social tests, social development tests, or academically, whatever, Montessori kids tend to outperform normals. And one of the main reasons they believe is because it's a high-flow environment. It's driving these kids into flow. But you're absolutely correct about being self-directed. And I'll give you, you want to hear something, to me this is the neatest thing. So I talked earlier about how really cool companies are starting to employ flow triggers in what they do. So one of the things, if you're going to kind of be self-directed and if you're going to always find new challenges to interest yourself, you've got to step it up, you need to be able to follow your passion. So Facebook does this really cool thing where after you've worked at Facebook for about a year, you can, it's called Hack-a-Month. You can move to any department in the company that you want to for a month. You can just jump into that department and work on their project. And afterwards, if you like it a lot, you can petition them to stay. So this is really key for organizations interested in flow because you need, we've got this whole culture built on vertical advancement. Got to get better, got to move up the ladder. But to actually create really high flow environments, and this is in our organization, so this is in our schools, this is also in our businesses, you need horizontal freedom. You need to be able to follow, you know, what you're curious about horizontally, not just vertically.
I read this whole book and was, you know, just sort of following along, not being able to always fully get what these people on their skateboards or surfboards or whatever were doing. But, you know, that's cool, and I totally get that people love that. But the things that are important to me, and when you talk about ultimate human performance, I look at the world that I'm living in and think that ultimate human performance would mean living in peace with one another, having an egalitarian society, having good food available to everybody, things like that. Is there any connection between what I'm talking about and what you're talking about with ultimate human performance?
Yeah, sure. I think there's two. So first of all, let's just talk about the egalitarian component for a second. One of the things that's really interesting about flow is all of these neurochemicals. So norepinephrine and dopamine, that's romantic love. Those chemicals show up when we fall in love. Anandamide, endorphins, these are social bonding chemicals as well. So one of the things that flow does that's so interesting is it massively increases the amount of empathy people feel. Psychologists say people are more complex on the other side of flow states. That's a fancy way of saying.
But I'm going to challenge you for a minute right now, just before you even go on. You talk about CEOs who are in flow states. CEOs are notorious for making 500 times as much as their lowest employees, and they have no empathy whatsoever.
Well, I'm not saying, first of all, there's a huge difference between self-actualization and flow. Flow is a state. It's a brief temporary thing. It's not a stage of development. Flow state can give us a glimpse at the next stage of development. It can help us progress through that stage, but you can get stuck there. I mean, there's no, you know, the action sport athletes that I interviewed, these guys are not Buddhas. They're totally human and very fallible.
And
you know,
hedonists perhaps a little bit.
And, you know, in top executives, we know there's a high correlation of narcissism in executives. So there's, you know, there's other things going on. But what I am saying is that we do know that flow states make people more empathetic. Now, where they started from and where they're ending up, that's a totally different thing. I also want to say, and this is kind of the last chapter in the book, but this is, I think, the bigger point, which is, you know, my last book was called Abundance. And the core idea at the heart of Abundance is that these four forces in the world today that allow us to significantly raise global standards of living, which speaks to exactly your point, right? But the point we make in Abundance is this is not techno-utopianism. It's not technology alone is going to get us there. It's this opens an adjacent possible. We can possibly raise these standards of living, and that's amazing. But to do it, it's going to require the biggest cooperative effort in history. And it's not just showing up and cooperating. We need the best possible versions of ourselves showing up. We need the best possible version of cooperation. We know that's group flow, and we know the best possible versions of ourselves show up in flow. So I think fundamentally, if we're going to actually get anywhere close to a world of abundance, we need more flow in this world. We need, nobody in this world doesn't want heightened creativity, accelerated learning, and deep motivation, right? Which are the three main things that flow jacks up. All those things are fundamental to kind of innovation and forward progress in all the categories that you mentioned, right? So to me, flow is fundamental to our advancement.
Stephen Kotler is author of the new book, The Rise of Superman, Decoding the Science of Ultimate Human Performance. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
And you can find out more about the book and about Stephen's work at the website riseofsuperman.com.